Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, it is once again Old Florida Day. You know, there's an aspect of Florida history that even native Floridians in many cases haven't heard of or don't know much about. And it's something that happened around the end of the 1800s and the beginning of the 1900s. There was a fashion mania among women all over the country, but particularly up the eastern seaboard, for having the most beautiful bird plumes in their hats, right? And this spread to Europe. And so what devolved out of that fashion craze was what was then called the plume trade. And really, the birds that provided these beautiful plumes that were very airy and gorgeous to look at, like a snowflake only in, you know, in bird feather form, were largely wading birds that existed primarily in South Florida, around the Everglades and in the Everglades, in rookeries. And in many cases, they were the plumes that only appeared on these wading birds during mating season. So they were intended by nature to make the bird look as showy as possible. And of course, the women who wore the hats felt that they were therefore as showy as possible. But the demand for these feathers grew rapidly and became like insatiable, and the supply was limited. And what it did was it drove the price of these plumes sky high. And so naturally, there was like a gold rush into parts of South Florida that had been almost not penetrated by white men before, to really try to wipe out these rookeries to shoot these birds and get their feathers and sell them into this very lucrative market. So my guest today is a prominent land use attorney in West Palm Beach. His name is Harvey Oyer III, and he is a descendant of one of the very early pioneer families in South Florida. He's written a book that's really aimed at children, a children's book that's based on family stories and kind of the written history of one of his ancestors named Charlie Pierce, whose family was kind of in the middle of all this trade. They weren't involved in it, but he wrote a story about a young boy's adventures relative to the plume trade. Welcome, Harvey.
Thank you for having me, Cord.
Appreciate you being on. So why don't we just start off by talking about your book. What's the name of the book and what's it about?
The book is entitled The Adventures of Charlie Pierce and subtitled The Last Egret. It's actually the second book in a series that is entitled The Adventures of Charlie Pierce. And the books were really designed to teach Florida history to children in an entertaining way. My goal in writing the book series was to find a way to teach children something about Florida's unique history and topography and geography without causing them to memorize a bunch of facts and dates and events, which is the way they're normally taught in school.
And I should say that Harvey is a really serious historian. I think you have a degree in history from Cambridge and also an archaeologist. So he's somebody who's very attuned to the natural world. And then with his deep roots in South Florida history, is attuned very much to the history of Florida and how those two things, the natural history of Florida and the environment and the history of the state, intertwine. I think your family was, I've read, the first inhabitants of really the first white inhabitants of South Florida, right? The Pierces that you descend from, I think they owned Hypoluxo Island, which is in the middle of Lake Worth, got there about 1872, but you could tell that briefly better than I could.
Well, our family were not the first inhabitants, but we were the first to permanently stay. There had been over a period of time when Florida was a Spanish territory and a brief period in which Florida was a British possession, and even after we became a U.S. territory and state, that others were here before us, but it was a very inhospitable environment, and it was lightly populated except for Seminole Indians, who, of course, for many years were at war with America. So having no roads, no railroads, no inland waterways, no grocery stores or churches or temples or doctors, it was a pretty unfriendly place to live. So while others were here before us, they didn't stay long, and our family was probably dumb enough to come here and stay here.
Well, or adventurous enough, and certainly they were living in, you know, it'd be like the equivalent of parachuting into the middle of the Amazon or something at that time, because there was no connection to white American civilization, right? So these were pretty, the original papa who came down was very brave, and I think his wife was equally brave, right? But they had some children, right? So one of the children is then the center figure in your book.
Well, that's a very accurate analogy, parachuting into the Amazon. In fact, the first book in the series was subtitled The American Jungle, because truly South Florida was the American jungle. By the 1870s, all of the western portion of the United States had been explored and was in the process of being settled. And the last truly unexplored, unsettled portion of America, believe it or not, was South Florida, and really the bottom half of the peninsula, until the Florida Everglades were drained, which would not occur until about the turn of the 20th century, and a railroad was put in on the East Coast by Henry Flagler and the West Coast by Henry Plant. It was a very inaccessible, inhospitable place to live. Consequently, there were not many people here. And my family moved here in 1872, my great-great-grandparents, and they brought with them their 8-year-old son, Charlie Pierce. And later, my great-great-grandmother would have a daughter named Lily, who was my great-grandmother. But in the first book, it was Charlie's adventures with the only friend that he could make, a Seminole Indian boy named Tiger Bowlegs. And they established a friendship that would last a lifetime. And the second book, entitled The Last Egret, occurs when they're teenagers. And at this point, there were a few other pioneer families who had moved to the area that is today modern-day Palm Beach County. And Charlie and Tiger Bowlegs and two brothers that had moved to the area named Guy Bradley and Louis Bradley set off on this adventure deep into the Florida Everglades to hunt plume birds. And unfortunately for them along the way, or so they thought, my great-grandmother, Lily, who was a bit of a tomboy who followed them everywhere they went, she stowed away in the boat and went with them. So now they were stuck with Charlie's little sister on their adventure, and I cannot imagine too many things that would be worse for teenage boys than to run away on a big adventure and find out you have your little sister with you. But that's exactly what happened, and it took place over about a 5-week period where these teenagers sailed down the east coast of Florida and hunted birds along the way for the plume feathers, birds of all varieties. They were in search, though, of the snowy egret, and that is because the snowy egret's plumage was the most valuable. And after trying their hand at modern-day Broward County up the Cypress Creek and modern-day Miami-Dade County by traveling up the Miami River into the Florida Everglades, they eventually wound up at the bottom of Florida, down around Cape Sable, which is today Everglades National Park. And it was there that they did encounter a snowy egret rookery. But after some weeks of hunting birds and realizing the destruction that it created, the smell of the rotting bird carcasses, the frustration on behalf of Tiger Bowlegs, the Seminole Indian, whose culture did not allow or appreciate taking more from Mother Earth than one could use, and a whole series of other events shaped the moral learning arc of these children to the point that once they did encounter the elusive snowy egret rookery that they had been seeking, really the holy grail of all bird rookeries that would have been worth tens of thousands of dollars in 1880s dollars, they made the decision to not shoot any of the birds, but instead put down their weapons and come home. And the experience profoundly affected all of the children. And I say children, they were teenagers, but it affected the rest of their lives. And I think the most telling story is that Guy Bradley, one of the teenagers on this expedition, used his share of the money or proceeds from selling the feathers of the birds that they did kill to move back to Cape Sable at the bottom of the peninsula of Florida, buy a piece of land, and as an adult become a wildlife conservation officer, patrolling the same area that he had hunted in as a teenager, trying to prevent plume bird hunters doing exactly the same thing that he had done. And I wish I could say there was a happy ending, but there was not. In July of 1905, Guy Bradley was shot through the throat and killed by plume bird hunters that he was attempting to arrest. And his death, though, did have some positive outcomes. The outrage from his death, which incidentally was the first wildlife conservation officer in American history to be killed in the line of duty, not only made newspaper headlines in Florida and throughout the nation, but even around the world. And it was due in part to his death that Congress enacted laws that protect our birds today. And it was really, I believe, his death that gave momentum to to the Audubon Society movement, which had existed for a while but really had no momentum. And after Guy Bradley's murder, the Audubon Society grew rapidly. And, of course, it's one of the preeminent wildlife conservation organizations in the world today.
That's a great story, Harvey. And the amazing part is that really your entire book, as far as I can tell, is only a little fictionalized. It's really taken from the journal of your, I think, great-uncle, Charlie Pierce, who later became the postmaster of Boynton Beach for many years and was himself a prominent person in Florida's history later on throughout his life. But I think, why don't we back up to say, I mean, we don't want to leave the impression that these kids were bloodthirsty, greedy plume hunters. There was a reason they set off on this expedition, which they called the Great Plume Bird Expedition, and they did it in secret. So why don't you tell kind of the background within their family, that part of the story?
Well, you're right, Court. There was a more noble cause in the children's minds than killing birds. Our family was in danger of losing our family home. The homestead was High Paluxo Island, which is an island in the middle of what is today the Intercoastal Waterway in central Palm Beach County. And our family owned the entire island for free under the Federal Homestead Act. But once property taxes became effective in South Florida, our family was at risk of losing the island. And Charlie and Lily loved the island, and they thought that this would be a good way to earn some money to save the island. So the kids did have the best of intentions, but what they learned along the way is no amount of money was worth the destruction that they were causing. Part of it was is they saw millions of birds flying in Florida in that century, and what difference would killing a couple hundred birds make? And what they learned in this process was the cumulative effect of their actions. And the Seminoles drew a wonderful parallel to that, which I include in the book, of the Coonti plant, which is a plant that has grown in Florida for thousands of years and been harvested and used by the Native Americans for thousands of years to make starch for bread and biscuits. And the Coonti plant was wiped out within a few decades of contact by the white man who over-harvested it, either not knowing or not caring that it takes 30 years for a Coonti plant to reach maturity. So if you over-harvest, you're out of luck. They're not going to grow back the next season. And the Seminoles refused to hunt the plume birds because they had had this prior experience with the Coonti plant. And I think all of this is a great analogy for what our world is faced with today. This was the greatest environmental disaster in American history, and certainly in Florida's history, until today. Today we're dealing with this oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico that may eclipse this bird hunting episode in Florida's history as our worst environmental disaster. And I think the book could not be more timely. It was published this year, 2010, which is the declared year of the Everglades. And it has a story, not just of Florida history, but it's a message of conservation at a time when our generation and the next generation needs to do a better job with preserving the planet that we have. And I think there are lessons in here for children. I know I have a 10-year-old daughter that likes to take a long shower, and I tell her, turn off the shower, you're wasting water. And she says, well, what's 5 more minutes of water? Hmm. Well, after she read the book, The Last Egret, which was, what is the big deal about killing just a few birds? There seems to be millions. She now shuts the shower off and gets out and says to me, I don't want to waste any water because the cumulative effect is bad for our planet. And that's exactly where I want the next generation to be.
Well, that's a good example of the impact of a book like yours on children and how it can have a really lasting, lifelong impact that changes minds permanently. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with lawyer and author Harvey Oyer III, who's with us on the phone from West Palm Beach, about his book, The Adventures of Charlie Pierce, The Last Egret, which is a book that really comes from his family history, one of the pioneer families in Florida, directly out of the experiences of his great-uncle, Charlie Pierce, who at the time of the book was a teenager and who kept a journal all his life. And so a lot of his experiences are actually written down, and this book derives directly from them, about the experiences of Charlie Pierce and his sister, who stowed away on their adventure, and some friends during the great plume hunting period. It was called the plume trade at that time in South Florida, when all of the rookeries of magnificent wading birds, particularly the more beautiful, the worse it was, were shot out by hunters, greedy people who were after the plumes that were on these birds, and some of them brought as much as $32 an ounce in New York markets, twice the price of gold. So let's talk for a minute about this trade. I mean, it really is, it's kind of an example of the way that humans have a passion for nature and its beauty, but they carry it too far. I mean, and you see this in, oh, I don't know, in the ivory trade in Africa, where a lot of Asians love and covet carved little statuaries and trinkets made from ivory, and yet they're driving elephants extinct in the process. Earlier in even in Florida's history, there were fairly large populations of crocodiles. They were never as numerous as alligators, but they were pretty well driven near to extinction by the passion for alligator shoes and belts and bags. Alligators themselves were finally protected, and they were heavily pressured by hunting. Now, of course, they're quite prolific again. But I mean, another example is billfish. That used to be that the standard thing when people went offshore fishing to catch a marlin, let's say, would be to kill it, bring it back to the dock, hang it up, take some pictures, and then mount it, or even just cut the bill off and mount that. So people wanted parts, trophies, let's say. So between trophy hunting and fashion, we pressed hard the wildlife of this country, and particularly in South Florida. So the plume trade was really intensely located in South Florida, as I said at the beginning, and as Harvey was describing. And the actual people who killed the birds, who at the bottom of the food chain, so to speak, were getting about 25 cents a plume for the best plumes. They were called aigrettes. They were the really feathery, billowy, brilliantly white plumes of the snowy egret, which has had many names. It's now, I think, called the American egret, but it was called snowy egret and great white egret. And really, various kinds of birds. I'm going to give a little tutorial here because this is not that well known, but various herons and egrets were the targets of these things, particularly egrets. And so it was the great white heron is the young version, the immature version of the what we know as the great blue heron. So the great blue herons and the white herons were shot fiercely. And then the various kinds of white egrets, the snowy egret and the reddish egret and the great egret, they were all shot very avidly by these hunters who would go, they would trek deep into the Everglades to find hidden rookeries. And the Seminoles participated to some extent in this, but I think more reluctantly, and also they were kind of pressed into service. I mean, you're talking about, you know, a population of people, so some would be a little more susceptible to bribery and payment than others, or to being put under pressure than other people would be. But there was a famous French trapper who became a bird hunter named Jean Chevalier, and he became kind of a semi-legendary figure down that way. But among the herons, the little blue heron and the green heron and the great white heron, the great blue heron I mentioned, they were all targeted. The roseate spoonbill was driven nearly to extinction. At one point, in I think about 1906, there were only 9 known nesting pairs of roseate spoonbills left. And these are still rare today. I've seen a couple over the Mosquito Lagoon in east central Florida, but they're hard to find. And I don't know how many nesting pairs there are, but I would guess it's in the hundreds, if that. And they had beautiful light pink pastel colored plumes. So this is long before synthetic products were readily made, right? So people used natural products like this without thinking what the impact on the environment would be. It was so disconnected. People didn't think in terms of the environment, right? So people, you know, ladies, fashionable women in New York buying a hat for $150, which, by the way, was about twice the weekly earnings of the average person working in the millinery trade making those hats. So we're talking about the earnings for 2 weeks of one person would go to buy one hat. And the most desirable feathers would be on those hats. And the rarer they got, the higher the price went. The ecological impacts of this were extraordinary. As Harvey was saying earlier, people would go in and these birds were nesting all in one large tree or one kind of hammock or cluster of trees. And they would sneak up on them and shoot them with rifles that tended to make little noise, and they used very little powder. They didn't want to disturb the birds, who were noisy anyway and making a lot of noise in their excitement about mating and feeding and raising chicks. And they would shoot them over about a two-day period until they basically shot it all out. That was the term. They shot out the rookery. And what were left, aside from the rotting bodies that Harvey mentioned, were the chicks in the nests, who would then starve to death or be eaten by predators. So they wiped out the entire generation of this colony of these birds, you know, and so it was extremely hard for these to come back. Many of these were driven nearly extinct, and in our time, habitat loss is putting as great a pressure in many cases on these birds as the hunting once did. Can you speak a little bit to that, Harvey, maybe?
Well, there's several key issues in there. One, as you pointed out, it was not only the adults that were being killed for their feathers, but the unintended consequence was wiping out the next generation, because they were killed during mating season when their plumage was the finest. That, by definition, meant that they had either eggs or chicks in their nest that were left to die. So two generations were being wiped out instead of one. And the consumers in New York, Paris, London were being peddled a story that these feathers were being picked up off of the ground, feathers that had fallen off of birds. And that, of course, was not the case at all. In the millions of birds were killed, and because Florida was, you know, the rookery for this hemisphere, most of those birds were coming out of this unexplored, remote Florida Everglades. And the second thing that you said that I'm not sure most people are aware of today is that the assault against these birds and any number of other animal species continues today, not because we're hunting them, but because we are taking away their habitat. The Florida panther is an excellent example of that. There are fewer and fewer Florida panther because as we encroach on their habitat, developing westward from the east coast of Florida and eastward from the west coast of Florida, they stop reproducing because they simply don't have enough habitat. And the same occurs for the birds. And then we compound the problem by this additional development creates more fertilizer runoff from watering yards and petroleum runoff from the streets and roads when it rains, and this gets in our water supply, and it disturbs the very biology and chemistry of the animals, and it causes them to not reproduce or reproduce unhealthy species. So there are still great challenges today, even though we're not physically shooting at any of these animals. They are still under great stress. And if you add to this an oil spill that could blanket the estuaries of Florida, which is where the fish that these wading birds feed on live, we could be in for just as great or greater of a disaster than young Charlie and his sister and friends experienced 100 plus years ago.
Well said. So going back to the end of the plume trade and how this absolute onslaught on all the wading birds of South Florida ended, the American Ornithologists Union was a league of scientists, really, who were ornithologists, and the Audubon Society was just a fledgling organization, to make a bad pun at the time, was just getting off the ground, and they were aware that these feathers were not being picked up off the ground, as the marketing PR was putting it, but that they were really derived from wholesale slaughter of entire flocks and populations of birds. So they worked together, and really the Florida Audubon Society was one of the most active ones of all, in connection with, oddly enough, the Florida Federation of Women's Clubs. Women wearing these hats, but the women in Florida knew where they were coming from, right? And they valued the environment and the natural beauty of Florida. So they all got together and really put pressure on the Florida legislature. And the first thing that happened was in 1900, the Lacey Act was passed, which prohibited the interstate trade of wildlife killed in violation of state laws. So that was kind of vague in a way. It was the interstate trade of wildlife that were killed in violation of existing laws. But the existing laws protecting these birds were very weak, so they really had to then go back and make a set of laws that made it illegal to do this specific thing, which was to hunt for birds for their plumage. So in 1901, just a year later, they were able to persuade the legislature to pass the what was called the Audubon Model Law, outlawing plume hunting in the state. And so that then allowed the Audubon Society to raise funds to pay for a few game wardens, like Guy Bradley, that Harvey described at the beginning, who really was a neighbor and friend of his forebears' family there. And so Guy Bradley was hired as a warden in South Florida. There was another one named Columbus McLeod, who was hired and put on in duty in Charlotte Harbor, along with two other people, protecting a very, very large rookery there. And he was killed in 1908. So this was a dangerous occupation, because you were up, I mean, it was kind of like the drug trade, in effect. You were up against people who were ruthless, greedy, and had nothing to lose. They were 50 miles from the nearest other American. And if they killed somebody out in the bush, unless they bragged about it while drunk later, really nobody found out about it except that the person disappeared. So there were a whole series of steps, really, that by 1904, the Florida Audubon Society was really heavily engaged in educational efforts for trying to suppress this trade. And it finally did work with the killing of Guy Bradley first and then Columbus McLeod later. But, boy, not before these birds were almost entirely decimated and some were brought to the edge of extinction. Well, I think we may have just enough time, Harvey, for you to read a passage from your book, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, I'd be delighted to, Court. It actually comes from the epilogue of the book, beginning on page 160. We were far from the last plume hunters in southern Florida. There is no way to describe the plume trade in those years except to say that people were consumed with their greed. When we returned from our trip, snowy egrets were already selling for almost $100 a bird, and the demand only went up from there. In New York, they piled the ladies' hats higher and higher with plumes until you couldn't hardly see the ladies' heads underneath all those feathers. And they used every kind of bird you could imagine. I learned much later that 64 species of birds were hunted for their plumage, and most of those came from the Florida Everglades. I was right, too, about what would happen to the birds. It turned out that shooting birds and rookeries was like a two-for-one in terms of killing. Those birds were mating, so many of them were sitting on nests. Once the birds were shot, there was no parent to protect the egg, so the eggs and the chicks died too. The hunters were killing two generations of birds, not just one. And, Court, that, of course, comes from the epilogue of the book after the teenagers returned from the Great Plume Bird Expedition. Of the many endorsements of the book, I'm proudest, though, of an endorsement from Frank Gill, who is the current president of the National Audubon Society and a past president of the American Ornithologists Union, and probably the greatest bird scientist in the world. And he wrote in the book, not only is the last egret an enthralling adventure story, it presents a vital message, perhaps even more important today than it was in the 19th century. Only if we understand and love the natural world will we preserve it. This is a book that will surely excite young people about the heritage that they must preserve.
Harvey, it's a very well-written book, and I recommend it to particularly to anyone with kids from, from 5 or 6 on up through late teenage. It's easily understood. It's well-written, but not heavy-duty. You know, it's written for, I'd say, teenage kids primarily, but younger kids can certainly understand it. It's called The Adventures of Charlie Pierce, The Last Egret. The author, again, is my guest, Harvey Oyer, O-Y-E-R, the third. And it's available through Amazon.com and Borders and directly from a website, theadventuresofcharliepierce.com. Harvey, thank you so much for being on and talking about your book and about the plume trade and about South Florida history, an aspect of it that not too many people know much about.
It was my pleasure, Court. Thank you so much.
And thanks to you all for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.